Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's episode is powered by TD Ameritrade. Every stroke counts on the scorecard and every penny counts in the market. That's why TD Ameritrade is committed to straightforward pricing with no surprises, so you're free to swing with confidence. Visit tdameritrade.com/friedegg. Member SIPC. In today's episode, I welcome on Jaeger Kovich and Clyde Johnson. Jaeger and Clyde are two of the industry's most promising architects. Each has worked for some of the best architects, including Tom Doak and Gil Hans, as well as completing some solo work of their own. They are two of the most well-traveled people in golf. They've played everywhere. Along with their travels for golf architecture, they hit up famous courses as well as, you know, the hidden gems. These guys get around, and they're responsible for our new series on the website, The Eclectic 18 of the United Kingdom. So in this podcast, we talk about each of their travels as well as the process that they went through to put together the 18 best holes in the UK. So go into kind of what the whole series about and why they did it. So we recorded this podcast the week of the Open Championship, and we're now on hole three. So check out the series on thefriedegg.com and be sure to follow Clyde and Jaeger on Instagram.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
What's your guys' favorite fruit?
It's got to be the banana, right?
Yeah. You could guess mine without even thinking about it. it's actually the only fruit I eat. Although the strawberry ice cream or the strawberry milkshakes at Ginetta's in St. Andrews are world class.
The only fruit you eat is banana.
Or strawberry in a milkshake.
Oh wow! What do you? You don't eat any other fruit? You've never had like mango or blueberry?
No, I'm a raw carrot man, to be honest.
Oh, carrots must have good eyes.
Yeah, I have memories of Clyde trying to peel carrots with just like blunt butter knives on the kitchen table over there at Dismal River, like the first couple of weeks. Oh man, he was making a mess with the carrots and Rice Krispies freaking every morning. It was unbelievable.
That's why I don't peel the carrots anymore.
What? There are a lot of guys that worked on that Dismal project.
There are a ton, man. Absolutely. Got Zach Vardy, who's still working with Corin Crenshaw, Blake Conant, who's still doing a lot of work with Tom, and helps out with Kai and Schneider a lot, and Eckenrode. Who else? Brett, Jeff. Yeah. Ryan Jans played a part in Bel Air, right?
Yeah, big pop.
That's, yeah. So, lots of guys. That's what's it like working with a lot of young guys at the same time? Like, you guys were all interns at that point, right?
Yeah, definitely. There were, like, you know, basically 10 college kids with a rake and a shovel. And if you were really lucky, it was like a turn on the Sand Pro or, you know, early morning on the Schneider might give you a couple hours on the dozer to go do some grunt work or something like that. But mostly it was like a rake and a shovel. And Brian was there kind of running the show. Jonathan Reister was shaping most of the bunkers, at least the year we were there. They did, I guess, like a good handful of greens the previous year with an even smaller crew. I don't know. It was just
a good way to learn. If you can learn how to run a rig, you can learn how to run a dozer. If you can learn how to run a shovel, you can learn how to run an excavator. And just time watching Ryan Schneider and the other associates when they were there is pretty invaluable.
Yeah, it was probably pretty cool and helpful too that there was like nothing else to do there, right? I mean, you're trapped in Moen, Nebraska, like, you know, a 30 minute ride to Moen, Nebraska, a town of 491 people. So it's like, you know, just nonstop like golf banter, really, if you were like interested in it. I mean, you could be up at 6 a.m. Talking about, you know, little details out there on site, or, you know, wherever our next golf course we wanted to see was. I mean, we were counting our dope points in the middle of the lunchroom too one day, Clyde, Zach, and I. We'd be going till like dark every night and wake up and do it again. There was nothing else to do. It was just
coming from the UK. I mean, I never imagined that I'd ever go and play sandhills or prairie dunes, and we were sort of in the middle of nowhere. But the middle of nowhere was pretty handy for seeing some pretty cool and important pieces of golf course architecture.
Yeah, and like, I mean, even so, it was not just like the middle of nowhere, but that was like the most minimalist golf project that like has almost ever been done, right? I mean, there were like 12 greens that were like tracked in, like tilled, cleaned up all the sort of duff grass, kind of tracked it in, sand proed it off, O'Brien did, and, you know, called it good within like, there was like very, very little to do in terms of that. So it was really like a, you know, just total crash course in what minimalism could be. I mean, pretty awfully inspiring, I'd say.
Yeah, learning what to touch and what not to touch was pretty good early lessons.
Right.
How much would you compare like that American Lynx land and Nebraska, and you touched on prairie dunes and Kansas, to the UK?
The scale's way bigger, I think, compared to most courses. You maybe get a touch of the bigger stuff on the west coast of Scotland to a lesser extent, and definitely on the west coast of Ireland. But, you know, the dunes tend to be sharper in their style, and, you know, the golf, you know, is often tackles it straight on, whereas, you know, those projects seem to have a little bit more sophistication to them.
And snakes.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, snakes in Australia are worse.
So you guys have both spent a ton of time in the UK. Clyde, you're from there. And then Jaeger, I know you spent a lot of your life over there. Tell us a little bit about, you know, Clyde growing up there and going other places, and then Jaeger growing up in America and going there, and how your golf perception changed.
Yeah, so I guess my interest in golf came. I had an old brewer. As my sister liked that, I was either adopted or an accident. So my older brewer was 11 years older than me, so I got into golf playing pitch and putt when we were on holiday. I was probably about 3. He would have been 14. And I sort of grew up on the edge of the Lake District in the northwest of England. And we had a small house, but it came with a little half-acre field, which we had 5 sheep to mow it. And we just used to start by hitting golf balls in that, mowing out with a petrol cylinder mower and sticking bamboo canes in with flags. And then by the time I got older, about 10 or 11, you know, that's when we really started. I was lucky being the youngest one. Sort of by the time I was 11 or so, it was only me going on holiday with my parents. So a lot of our holidays we always holidayed to the UK, Scotland, England, and, you know, to the coast. And most of my holidays were based around seeing golf courses, 18, 36 holes a day. At that point, my dad would come and pull my trolley for me, and my mum would just have to find something to do all day and meet up for dinner, pretty much. So that was my introduction to golf in the UK.
Well, I mean, I guess I grew up in New York City. I wasn't a member anywhere. I learned how to hit balls by taking a shuttle bus over to the Randall's Island driving range and dragging my dad's old Cubs over there. And, you know, that was sort of, you know, how I first learned how to swing. And, you know, growing up in New York City, you kind of always had to travel somewhere to find a golf course. You always, just had to start, driving somewhere. And there's a bunch of different public options. And somehow I just started weighing, what I like, golf course wise, how far we had to go, price, things like that. I just sort of started analyzing, I think, golf courses like that. I guess my first real trip to the UK, it was actually the day after I graduated college, I guess. One of my best sort of family friends, as a sort of graduation present, offered to fly me over to the UK, and we played the Old Course the next day. That was the coolest thing ever. Actually, we only got a couple rounds in St. Andrews. We did the old, sort of the crash course, the Dunhill stuff. So Carnoustie, Kings Barnes. I actually had to run home for a postponed jury duty I couldn't get out of again. But so that was sort of like my first taste. And then I've always, Lynx golf and golf in the UK. And then really when I started working for Tom, I guess that was like 2012, I sort of recommitted myself to seeing just lots and lots and lots of golf courses. Just working for him, you really understand how important it is to travel and see different things and not just the courses that, might be in the open rota, but, the kind of quirky stuff, the stuff that's inland, that's, built, even some of the modern courses over there, I think are kind of interesting in their own way versus the ancient stuff. There's so much in sort of every different corner of the UK. And so I kind of kept going back and forth, probably at least once for almost like 4 years in a row, I think it was. It's probably been 6 or 7 total trips to the UK for me now of like various lengths. But I always kind of find, sometimes I want to go back and see something that I'd seen when I was much younger. Now that I have maybe a different perspective, sometimes it's I want to go study more of like a, I saw one golf course by a particular architect, say like J.F. Abercrombie, I just had a total crush on the Addington the first time I saw that. So then the next time I went back, I tried to go, at least pick another one of his courses off, maybe that was in the area. So there's like sort of lots of different things that and different reasons that you get, like keep getting pulled back. There's still so many different corners I need to get to. I don't know.
And Clyde, you've been to about every corner, huh?
Yeah. you're talking golf courses? I've been pretty fortunate. I guess it showed you how into it I was, or perhaps how sad you are, depending on your opinion. I think I was 8 years old when I picked up my first golf magazine, and it was the 1996 Golf World UK magazine, top 100 in Great Britain and Ireland. And I think I've made it to 97 of those. And then I'm at the point now where I just enjoy really seeing under the radar, really, really, really under the radar courses. Went to the Isle of Iona last summer, which was really cool. That was £1 to play. You buy your scorecard from the post office or one of the hotels, and there's literally just sheep moan. But it's about as pure. About pure of the links experiences you'll ever find.
Are there many links courses left that you haven't seen at this point? It seems like it can't be many.
A few. Don't tell Tom I've never been to Pacific Dunes or any of the ones in America, but I've seen most that are worth seeing in the UK, probably about 200 or so of them. So there's there's normally always one hole or one feature, you know, that's worth seeing or something to learn from.
What's interesting to me is, Jaeger, you touched on this growing up golfing in New York is, and you know, I lived in Chicago, the city, for like 10 years. Is like a 7-hour excursion to golf for a city dweller isn't a big deal. And in the UK, a 7-hour excursion, you can go almost like anywhere on the mainland.
Yeah, you've probably driven past about 50 to 100 really good golf courses, yeah. even ones that people haven't heard of. They're pretty good.
They're right. Their perspective on distance is so warped, especially when they come to this country. Like, we'd be sitting in the middle of nowhere, Nebraska, and Claude would be like, oh, well, look, that one's just like, you know, it's just right there to Prairie Dunes, or, you know, it's right up there, Sutton Bay, or, you know, like, dude, do you not understand how far that is on the, like, 1 inch is like 7 hours worth of driving. It's wild. So, but I mean, the guy we're talking to has no, he doesn't care. He's going to wake up at 3 a.m. and drive 7 hours to see, you know, you just got to pack them all in. You just got to be willing to do like 36, 54 a day, make it worth it. See something cool on the way, you know, just like drive straight to the hits. You got to see, like, there's always probably something funky, like, on the way back. If you're willing to go for it, I guess. Like,
the worst one I've ever done was when I was on the helping out at Tauriti in New Zealand, and Mick Henderson, the Australian guy who's also on the art department there, me and him, well, his wife was back in Melbourne, so on our days off, we'd go and see the country golf courses of New Zealand. And one weekend, we drove 9 hours to go and see a 9-hole links course that was probably a dope too. So, but New Zealand, I mean,
we would have never seen Danbrog if we didn't go all the way to Firethorn.
Yeah, yeah.
I made both. Right. Was, how could you not? You know, I'll talk about that at least a couple times a year.
Yeah, that had one of the coolest greens imaginable. Cool, maybe not the right word, but wacky.
Sand green in the middle of a green silo.
Yeah, that's right. The second hole, I think.
Yeah, I was at Prairie Dunes a couple weeks ago, and Garrett Morrison and I stopped in to see Faldo's course right next to Prairie Dunes. And we drove in. I mean, you could see these beautiful dunes. It was like, oh, this thing could be amazing. We turned in, saw like four containment moundings that were identical size behind a green. And then the next hole we saw had a man-made lake. And then we drove in. There was no cars in the parking lot, and then turned around and drove out.
Shouldn't have gone in, man. It looks real good. Like, from what you can make out from the road, it looks awesome. So
great entrance.
That's on you. That's on you. It was best, like, to wonder sometimes.
It's like the best entrance too. It's like got this like great like kind of gravel road, and you're driving between dunes with this vegetation. But I think that's the joy though of it. Sometimes there's nothing, no better feeling I feel like than when you roll up and you find a course that very few to nobody knows about, and it just blows it, like your expectations are just exceeded.
Yeah, you gotta find out for yourself sometimes. You know, everybody's different. Everybody's got different tastes. You just got to go out there and keep seeing different things and, you know, find what you like, find what works for you. It's probably going to change as you see more, learn more, get older. I don't know, all sorts of different, but like, that's the cool thing. It's like just going to just discover something. Right. I don't know.
One of my favorite elements of seeing new golf courses is almost the adventure of getting to the places. You know, I look at the places I've been to that I probably never would have ever gone to in my life otherwise. You know, that'd be pretty cool.
No doubt.
Pretty cool landscape experiences from just seeing one picture of a golf course that, you know, it might be one good hole there in 18, but it looks like it could be really cool from a topo or a Google Earth, or just, you know, just one lousy website picture. And that's part of it.
And it's always different too, as to like what brings you there. Cause like, you know, sometimes all, you know, read everything I could possibly read on that golf course or that architect or like a whole bunch of the different holes that are on it. And sometimes it's like you see one picture, sometimes it's just a name on a list as you were going down and seeing something, or you just drove past it half the time in the UK. It seems like, I mean, there's all different things. It's always a bit of a, you know, sometimes you leave it as more of a surprise. Sometimes if it's like, man, you only know you're going to get one chance, you know, maybe it's worth doing a bit of bit more research on the way in. And then it's different, you know, if you walk versus play, and you're going to have a different experience. You're going to see a lot of different things. You might learn a lot more walking or versus playing. Kind of ideally, you kind of do the walk and then play if you have enough time, if you really, really, really want to learn about it. Yeah, I don't know. It's always different, right? That's the cool. They're all different.
Especially when you're in the UK as well. You go to the average golf course, and the chances are it's going to be pretty interesting because they never really destroyed any of the cool features that were part of the landscaping. You know, the towns were already pretty well established at that point. So the landscape or the, you know, the sites that were left for golf might not have been ideal, especially inland. And, you know, they're often quite funky. There's some funky feature or two that, you know, makes it worthwhile. And worst comes to the worst, you've probably only paid 20, 30, 40 quid at the average club golf course. And, you know, you're not too bad. 2.5 hours later.
Yeah. Less time and less money is an appealing thing about UK golf, you know?
Yeah. And that comes from less expectations too. You know, as long as the greens are playing pretty well, mm-hmm. you know, people aren't going to complain about the fairways being slightly scruffy or the tees not being completely flat.
So we just kicked off on the website your guys' series, the Eclectic 18 of the UK. So pretty neat. It's a hole by hole, and the rules of it are you can only pick a course once. So you can only pick one hole of a course once, and it goes in the order. So if it's the second hole at a golf course, it has to be the second hole in this routing of yours. Talk to us a little bit about kind of your process and the rules that you set for yourself for this Eclectic 18.
Well, I mean, the whole thing sort of came about in sort of a just funny, organic way, I guess. You would send me a text, I think, sometime over the winter, like, you know, what sort of whole deep dive from something in the UK I might be able to do, right? So I just started looking through some photos on basically every photo I had of every golf course I've ever been to in the UK. And I was like giving my friends a personal tour via group text. And one of them he's like, man, why don't you just pick like the best, you know, one? Like, well, what do you mean? And it's like, so it turned it into the Eclectic, which is, you know, not something we created, right? You know, these eclectic routings, where it's like, you know, the standard is, you know, the fourth at Woking has to be the fourth on your course. The 18th at St. Andrews would have to be the 18th on your course. And so, you know, that was pretty much, you know, just the basis of it. And, you know, we've seen them in the Confidential Guide. Tom always did one in the more recent volumes. He's got, you know, a consensus one between the four authors, and each one of them did individuals. So kind of as we were talking and I was going through all this stuff, I'm like, man, I don't know if I can do all of this on my own. Plus, you know, there's only, you know, Clyde's the person I really sort of, you can't really do it without him. I'm going to be asking him about every one of these anyways. So, you know, I figured we had to involve him. And then, yeah, so it's like an absolutely torturous process of trying to come up with these things. I spent like that week after we sort of came up with the idea, basically pulling my hair out. It's incredible. You know, I just started writing down, you know, the best sort of holes as I kind of went through. And then as I started piecing them together, you know, first I was like, well, maybe I could do the George Thomas thing, right? You know, pick five par threes and then route the par threes first, you know? So I tried to do that a couple of times, and within about five holes, I just bailed. I was like, yeah, this wasn't working. And I just kind of went my own direction. You know, often the holes I'd probably start with are like, you know, 11 at St. Andrews. I had awesome ones from Rye in, you know, sometimes even the 13th at the Addington. Like there's tons, but like, you know, I was always searching for the, like the sucker short, you know, I'm a sucker for like the short par three. So I started looking for things like that, and it just sort of kept evolving. I did like a whole bunch of them over the course of that week. And like, for whatever reason, I just, you know, I think that I would have ended up with lots of short par threes, short fours, like things like that. I kept ending up with like somewhere between like par 73 and 75 with all these like risk reward kind of funky par fives and things like that. But so I just kept driving myself crazy until I was able to finally narrow it down into sort of more of a cohesive like golf course that you might actually want to play every day versus getting your head beat in.
And that's kind of quite weird how you ended up with a par 73. Cause I mean, I think of most of my favorite golf courses in the UK, Great Britain, most of them are around 6,400 yards to play.
Well, that was the funny thing is they kept coming in at like 6,300, but somehow they'd be like, you know, over par 72. And I guess I just picked like all the shortest par fives in the entire country over there. It was like, I didn't, because they were the only ones I could get to, maybe. I don't know. Like, I it was just bizarre. So, once we kind of went back.
Short par five.
Yeah. Like, it's too funny. But, you know, there are other things like we really wanted to highlight in this piece, you know, really take people to places that they wouldn't maybe normally go or have heard of before. We're not just going to play the hits either. You know, there's a lot more to, you know, just the best hole at each. And then, you know, I think even as you look at like the first hole, right, you know, and the importance in the UK of like how the town's relationship to like the starting hole and the finishing hole. And, you know, you've got other things like, you know, railroad tracks, you know, all this sort of different culture aspect to golf in the United Kingdom that we kind of wanted to somehow intertwine into this.
I guess I started off by listing all my favorite holes from what I thought were, you know, the truly great golf courses over here. So that's the old course, obviously being the best anywhere, and then places like Muirfield, Dorna, Prestwick, North Berwick.
There's so many of those courses too, where you could use like six or seven holes from at least on a bunch of those, like, you know, and so you could kind of fill in sort of maybe some of the holes that didn't strike you as the strongest. And, you know, I mean, how many 13s did we look at and torture ourselves with on like the consensus? It's pretty amazing just how many, you know, of those world-class hole seems to, you know, stack up at the same number here or there. So, I don't know. It's funny. We kind of left out some of the real big ones too. They just didn't end up fitting in the end.
Yeah. There's a bunch of cool holes that, you know, someone like Sean Arbel, who's on post on Golf Atlas a lot, who would, you know, he likes to call them all England candidates or all Scotland candidates that are really cool that most people heard of. It would have pretty good merit, but, you know, the best golf courses are, you're the best because, you know, I've got the girls, and we probably gave the edge to those that were a little bit more well known than others in certain cases.
Yeah. I mean, it was funny too. We tried one consensus together. We just went one, we alternated 1, 2, 3, 4 odds and evens, and it did not work out well either. We scrapped that pretty quickly. It came out with a rather long. Was it a 73 again? Quite, I think maybe. And just like we sort of like forced, you know, going that way seemed to like, you know, we each just wanted to be like, you kind of just wanted to be able to pick the next great course versus, you know, tell the story maybe the way we were looking to do it. So what we ended up doing the second time was we sort of went with like, we alternated again, but you could pick kind of anywhere within the 18. So we kind of had like a draft, if you will. So, you know, the first hole we ended up picking was, I guess it was the 13th at North Berwick West, the pit. You know, I somehow won the coin toss for the first hole, and you know, I picked the hole that at the time was the hole in the whole United, the whole world that I wanted to see the most. When I finally got to North Berwick, that was easily the one hole anywhere in the world that just drew me to that place more than anything. In the past, it was, you know, at the time, the second on that list would have been the 10th at Riviera. So, you know, those are the kind of things that are worth getting on a plane for, I'd say.
But then, you know, you pick North Berwick West 13, and you're giving up the second hole at North, the great hole. You're giving up the 15th. That's a great hole, and you're giving up the 16th at North Berwick. It's got a great green site, and you know, it was a big balancing act.
So that's how you guys settle on it, is you went one by one.
Yeah, although there was definitely, you know, maybe a little bit of collusion, kind of, you know, it was the NFL draft week too. So, you know, there's always some behind the scenes action going on. You know, once we kind of started to see how things were going, you know, Clyde's also been to, like, you know, hundreds of more golf courses in the UK that I've been to. So there's places where he was going to be able to add something that I couldn't. So, you know, maybe we might have made a trade here or there so that I could, from my repertoire, that, and he could add in something a little bit more off the map. You probably, like, you know, I'm sure people are already hammering us for not picking Mac Rahanish on the first hole, but, like, I'd never been there, and I went with something else on the first hole. But so, you know, that's just how it goes.
Clyde, would your pick have been Mac Rahanish?
It was in the individual ones that we did. But you know, there's some, you know, someone like Hoylake's got a really good, strong, strategic long four. If that's where you want to go, the first hole at Royal Aberdeen's is a beautiful one that plays right out towards the North Sea.
I mean, people are always going to throw out, like, Berkshire Blue, the long par three. I wouldn't want to start that way. That's not my sort of ideal starting hole. I mean, to me, like, if you're going to do an eclectic 18, you want something that's going to have you, like, not being able to sleep for, like, weeks, knowing that your trip's coming. You want to be just so pumped as you're pulling into the parking lot. There's going to be something special that's going to make you, like, you're just going to be dreaming of hitting that first tee shot for, like, hours, days, much, like, you know, something that's really worth getting on the plane just to hit that one shot.
So tell me,
and then off you go.
Tell me about Prestwick's first hole that makes you feel that way. For those that, I mean, we put the article up about the first this week, and it'll be a weekly series going forward. Jaeger spoiled the 13th already, but that's fine. But the first hole at Prestwick, you know, like, what makes it a great first hole? What makes you dream about that tee shot?
Go for it.
It's the strategic use of the out of bounds, I think, that really does it for me. I mean, especially for the North, there's not many hole, you know, out of bounds common in the UK still. I mean, some of them have been neutered. Some of the famous ones, like the Dowie hole at Hoylake and the Royal hole there, have been neutered a little bit to some extent. You know, a lot of them survive still. It's just a combination of the out of bounds wall with the dune that it's in. It's just natural versus artificial, and just making use of what was there to make a really intriguing golf hole that never gets boring. You know, the closer you play to the out of bounds, the better angle you get in. And one of these days, you're going to hit the train that's coming from Glasgow down towards there. So you start aiming for the left, and you've got a horrible angle.
Yeah, you don't even have, like, the full reliability of, like, the being able to just smash a driver and off you go there. I mean, because you can hit it through the fairway if you hit an okay drive most of the time. So it's, like, you know, kind of one of those holes where there's, like, so many different strategies that there's, like, no strategy almost, and it's just an absolute free-for-all. Like, you can bunt one up there, you can hit a long iron, you can hit, like, literally anything you want off the tee, thing is, like,
you can hit a putter.
Can't miss. I mean, pretty much. Then, but it's then it's funny because then you have like the forced carry on the next one. So it's like, you know, if you really screw it up, you can really screw it up in a heartbeat. And it just funnels and funnels and funnels. The more length you want to hit, the more you want to rely on that big, you know, I personally just like to freaking smash the driver off the first hole because I know I'm not going to miss a tennis racket. I'm scared to death of like the long iron, but like, that's why, like, you feel it in your hands, like standing on the tee. Like there's no way to sort of replicate that feeling.
The green complex.
You know, and just like, pardon?
The green complex is pretty cute too. You know, there's the pot bunker on the front left that really squeezes it to make the reward for going down the railway line really worthwhile. Then it just sort of sits in a gentle saddle.
Yeah, and you can hit like nice little chip shots over the bunkers. They're like way back, you know, there's like some carry bunkers in the approach, but they're way back at like, I don't know, like 40, 50 yards short. So you can like chip and bump and run one up there, even if, you know, kind of from wherever, and, you know, start to get a little bit of that like taste for that fast and firm stuff kind of right off the bat. So it's really got about everything. And just like the historic nature of the place, like there's no way you can't pull into that parking lot dressed in a coat and tie, just knowing you're just going to have one hell of a freaking day. It doesn't matter how many times you've been there or whatever. It's just like, it's the first, you absolutely must get there. And, you know, it's open week, and that was the first open, right?
Yeah.
And the prevailing wind also is blowing from left to right, normally towards the out of bounds, and it's a surprisingly pretty hole as well. You've got the churchyard that sits on the hill above the railway line, and there's some beautiful textures with the heather and the marum and bent grasses on the left.
It was hard to see the textures the day we played because it was freaking snowing and hailing and raining, although we did get some sun for like two holes. It was one of the most ridiculous golfing experiences I've ever had in my life. We had the entire golf course to ourselves, having driven from St. Andrews across the country to Prestwick that morning, and like 2 inches of snow like blanketed the whole country. So we get out there and we're like, we've got videos of hitting tee shots out there. It's just like white everywhere. It's just absolute nonsense. So on a personal note, it just, that's a round of golf that I will never forget in my life. So, that's, you know, why not?
That's, I think there's no, the out of bounds line, the use of the out of bounds line is one of the most brilliant things in golf. It's so simple. But then right off the bat, like, there's no harder shot to flirt with an out of bounds line than the first one, because like nobody wants to be teeing up again, hitting three on the first hole. It's just like an ominous way to start any round.
Yep.
So with this week being the Open, I know, Clyde, you've been out to Port Rush. Jaeger hasn't. How many holes would you have had marked as considered for the Eclectic 18 from Port Rush?
We used to be the 14th hole. It's now the 16th hole after the recent reconfiguration to host the Open. That's a great long par three with depth to the right. You sort of play from the base of the dune, and you play up along the dune ridge. I'm pretty fond of the fifth hole that turns hard towards the ocean, short to mid par four. The short par three or the mid par three that follows that has got a beautiful green. Even the fourth hole is a great hole. It sort of plays across the side slope. The wind howling normally off the left towards the out of bounds on the right, and a cute little green that sits in a saddle, pretty bowl type green site. So it'd be three or four I'd be thinking pretty hard about.
Mm-hmm. So with Port Rush, what kind of unique characteristics does it have compared to the other open road courses that we typically see?
I think the elevation change probably is the first thing that comes to mind. It's fairly brawny in that sense of the word. You know, the first hole you play uphill, you sort of tack along the top five turns and doglegs towards the cliffs and Dunluce Castle in the background. And then the new holes, you drop into the former valley course, which is par five, the seventh, and an eighth that plays back up and along the ridgeline. You sort of tack back and in and around from the centre of the site. And then you sort of wrap up and over the top at the 15th. That's a beautiful par four that climbs and tumbles down over some rumbling terrain. And long looks pretty scary. And then about 200 yards beyond that, you've got the primary dune ridge and the waves that are crashing beyond that. And then after Calamity, it's an up and over that for the pros will be a pretty short par four, the 17th, so that'll be interesting to see. I think the green complexes as well. You know, I actually drove past Portrush on Monday, but I last played there last year with Brian Schneider, one of Tom's associates, and you know, we were pleasantly refreshed and reminded. It'd been about 10 years since I'd been there before, and a similar amount of time, if not longer, for him. And you know, just how cool the green complexes are. You know, Colt came in and did a redesign there, so most of the greens are his. And unlike most of the links courses that we know on the rota, you know, that have evolved a lot over time, there's a fairly consistent set of greens there that are just really elegant, and there's, you know, with big bold drop offs around them. You know, sort of, you know, if you miss, the recovery shot's going to be pretty interesting, I think, to watch this week.
Yeah, so those green complexes with the runoffs should be showcase short game a little bit more than we see year in, year out, and a lot of different types of shots is what you're saying, right?
Probably different types of shots. It's just the boldness of the, you know, the elevation that you've got to overcome if you miss the green at the short par three. Third hole is pretty interesting, sort of like on a little knoll. You know, if you miss that, you're going to be way below the green. Six again, another par three. But five as well, you know, if you miss that on the inside, the ball's going to tumble maybe 10, 12 feet below the green. You know, the greens are pretty receptive and those guys are good. It's, you know, it's sort of been a so-so summer in Ireland, and well, anyway, in Britain and Ireland in terms of the weather. It's been nowhere near as dry as last year. So it'll be relatively receptive. Mm-hmm. It just depends how the, you know, how much the wind blows as to whether those guys are going to be missing the greens enough to see those recovery shots, I think.
So with the Eclectic 18, you obviously, you got England, Scotland, and Ireland all together. How did it break down in terms of, you know, which of the three countries got the most golf courses in there?
England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. I'm not sure if we did include a hole from Wales. So it was fairly Scotland centric, I think.
Mm-hmm. I haven't really counted before. I'm just trying to.
I think England might have had the most.
Yeah, I think I just counted nine real quick for England. There you go. One Wales, one Northern Ireland.
Oh no, I don't think we had one from Wales in the end.
Maybe a honorable mention.
Yeah, you stole me on the pick. I was going to pick the seventh hole at Pennard, Wales, which is a James Braid.
True. Yep.
They call it Links in the Sky. You play. It goes out towards the cliffs of Moher, the south of Wales there. But the seventh is a beautiful, you know, mid par four that tumbles down, paying, you know, the estuary in the distance. The castle in the foreground, which is next to the castle ruins, next to the green site. Just really bold and rumpling, ruffled terrain. And then the green, so it's got a high section that rolls down into a bowl. And right beyond it is a view for as far as you can see down sandy estuary and towards the English Channel. So it was a pretty good hole to beat that one out. But Jaeger hadn't been there, so perhaps that's what really...
I think we ended up with a pretty good one, you know, a good representation, I think, for our list at seven. I don't know if we want to keep giving them away or what, but You know, we had to always throw in some quirk with, you know, back-to-back par threes somewhere or something funky like that, right?
Yeah, talk about the process of, you know, getting to make this imaginary routing. Like, and, you know, you've got your kind of gung-ho, a lot of gung-ho rules about architecture or faux rules, like, you know, par 72, it's not par 72. We got back-to-back
par they're all adjusted pars. Yeah, we get it.
But
did you figure out the adjusted par yet for ours?
No, I haven't. I'd have to really dive in. But I'm curious about was there a cadence or a rhythm or, you know, something that you guys were striving for or in the back of your mind when you were putting this together?
Well, we definitely wanted to make sure that our 18 represented shorter courses in general. I'd say we really didn't want to just emphasize like big, brawny, long holes and beat people up at all. You know, it seems like golf in the UK is really more, you know, some of our favorites are more like par 68, par 69. It's like the real sort of shorter courses. You know, you're going to see things like Swinley Forest, you know, where you're going to see 9-hole courses on our list. You're going to see like, you know, places that might have 6 par 3s, things like that. So it's not, you know, we're really trying to highlight those sorts of things, you know, and get people familiar with those types of courses that you'd see over there versus sort of your more kind of standardized thing you might golf course you might see in the States. And then it was also like a balancing act between inland courses, links courses, you know, more of like the bigger dunes, perhaps more in Scotland, you know, some of the other stuff along the English Channel. You know, you talked a little bit about, you know, the Open this week over in Northern Ireland. And it's like, you know, we were talking earlier about the difference between, you know, Ireland and Scotland and, you know, the links courses there, and how they might different, you know, feature wise. You know, it's funny because as we were talking about it before, it's like, you know, I've made probably 6 trips to the UK in general, and, you know, not one of them actually is yet to be in, you know, anywhere in Ireland. You know, it's like, well, there's some golf courses over there that are like super high on my list of places to see in the world, but maybe we wouldn't learn quite as much or be able to take away as much. And, you know, there might be one or two, you know, something more worth of interest for our work that you could find elsewhere. Maybe more in the Heathlands or somewhere like that. I don't know.
Yeah, and I tend to be a bit of a contrarian as well. So some of the picks, you know, just from the very nature of picking some slightly unusual holes, I think adds a little bit of diversity and interest to the makeup. Give it like to 18. I won't give it away, but I'm pretty sure no one will have guessed where I would have picked for the second hole.
Definitely not. Yeah, 18 was an interesting run, right? You know, it's balancing the town stuff there. You know, it's like I've had a bunch of people try to guess some stuff since the preamble came out like a week ago. And it's like, I'd say 4 out of every 5 guesses is wrong. You know, we didn't just go for the chalk hits either. You know, it's,
I mean,
there's definitely a few courses, personal favorites.
Picking a hole from St. Andrews is really difficult for me because, you know, I'd argue it's probably maybe got the best par 3 in the world. Definitely got the best par 4 in the world, and probably the best par 5 in the world too. You know, which one do you go for?
Mm-hmm. What
also, any architect that's ever played the old course more than Clyde at this point, who lives in St. Andrews and that's his home course? So it's pretty neat to have him try to figure out. You know, I had to leave the old course to him. There's no way I was taking that one away from him. I mean, it's the best tour guide anyone could have around there too. So that's pretty sweet.
I was gonna say, in terms of like, what, I guess what course or what hole was the toughest one to leave off this list?
Probably the road hole for me, which is giving it away a little bit. what we picked for. It hasn't given away what we picked for 17, but it's just pretty timeless, isn't it? It never. You know, I'm not a big fan of how they're mowing it. Currently, the mowing lines have taken away a lot of the strategy from how the hole should be played. But it just, you know, it never. It doesn't get any better than playing that second shot into the green or away from the green more often than not if you're trying to protect a score or you're just playing sensibly.
There's definitely like three courses on here that people are going to really wonder how the hell we left them off. But I think the one that, to me, that didn't end up in the consensus was Woking, actually. That golf course had such an incredible impact on inland golf and the history of like golf architecture, at least in terms of built golf architecture, we might say, versus found, if you will. It's in the honorable mentions. It was on my personal list, I believe, although I tortured myself on that one a bunch. But that to me was probably the one that I might miss the most.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't included anywhere from sort of like Royal County Down. You know, that's partly because I hadn't been there in about 10 years and I got to walk it a couple of weeks ago when the Ladies Amateur Championship was on. Walking around there, it's just like, oh, yeah, this is really good. How did we include anything from here? But, you know, so there's a little bit of bias in terms of how recently we've seen golf courses as well, no doubt.
Well, we can always do a revise, you know, an amendment, you know, or something different.
You never get it perfect, man. There's no way. It's absolute torture. Like, I went at it for like, you know, I must have done 10 of these over the course of like a week, and I'm not doing it again. It's not fun. You know, maybe we'll try one again in the U.S. or something like that at some time, but like it is brutal. I'm sure we'll just go down in flames on the internet for all our bad choices, but that's all right.
It's funny. Since we've started this conversation, all my head's been doing is been thinking about like an eclectic 18 of the Midwest. Clyde's talking about the road hole at St. Andrews.
I'm the Midwest.
And I'm like, you know, the road hole at Shore Acres is pretty good. You know, that should be the 10th hole. But it's funny. But then I'm like, oh, it could be the 11th there too. It's just like crazy how it gets your mind thinking when you do an exercise like this. It's like in you.
Yeah, I mean, you just talked. You're talking about like road holes and stuff like that. So that was a thing that crossed my mind a bunch when I was always doing mine. Is like, you know, holes did not just, you know, they had influence, not just, you know, at their golf course or maybe in the country, but like literally around the world. So, you know, there's been golf architects and people traveling to the UK, you know, forever that come back and, you know, Charles Burr McDonald, Tillinghast, Gil, Tom, I mean, Ben Crenshaw, like you name it, right? Everyone's gone over there and seen stuff and studied stuff and brought something back. And, you know, sort of some of that impact had to somehow find its way into our list. I think, you know, at least across my mind as to, you know, why I went there, you know, what might drive people to go there too. You know, at least from the US, right? You know, Clyde's perspective is different as someone that lives there and sort of, you know, was able to see a lot of these places, you know, without having to get on an airplane. But if you're gonna make that like leap, you know, sometimes there are things like that like, you know, part of what inspires you to go somewhere. But yeah, and then it's like, well, if you did one in the US, are you gonna, you know, how many of those kind of holes that are sort of replicated or templated off something else that you might put in there? But the US is so much bigger though. Like there's so many more choices.
And for what it's worth, there's plenty of stuff I've seen in American golf, especially American Parkland golf, that I'd love to bring back to the UK one of these days to an inland site. So it works both ways.
It's so, you know, kind of parting thoughts. Well, we, you know, since both of you guys are very, very well traveled, Clyde, you know, extraordinarily well traveled in the UK and even, you know, Australia, New Zealand, and Jaeger, extremely well traveled, extremely, you know, lots of trips to the UK. If you've never gone, where's the first place you got to go? You know, say you got 10 days.
I think there's more if you're a big golf course architecture fan, there's probably more diversity to be had from a trip to England, especially the southeast of England. But it'd be hard to, had the owner of South Cape in South Korea contact me for some advice very recently. I'd been there with Tom on a trip a couple of years ago on a trip, and I said to him the five courses that you absolutely must see: the Old Course, Dornoch Muirfield, and then Prestwick, North Berwick are the five you absolutely must see. And then, you'd think about putting places like Cruden Bay and Macrahanish in that list. But, there's quite a lot of travelling to be done there. So, you're just as good parking up in St Andrews for 5 days, playing the Old Course as much as you can, playing some of the cool little ones around there like Ely. The Eden Course at St Andrews got a really cool set of greens. Oh, it's got nine really cool greens that have survived. And then going and spending some time in East Lothian, stay in North Berwick, play Muirfield if you can, and then little places like Kilspindie, Gullen number 3.
Just play North Berwick every day. You'll be good. But
is that?
Yeah, I think you were. I think you're pretty good.
This is something I think about a lot. Like, is it better to see some of these places twice than seeing another place once?
Sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, you take ten rounds on the Old Course if it was given to you for 10 days. That's for sure.
Yeah, I didn't get. I mean, I was pretty young, and I guess you would say I wasn't woke yet, I suppose. The first time I saw it, the second time certainly made a huge difference to me there. But North Berwick, I ended up playing probably 3 or 4 days in a row, or at least 4 days within a week. And just going around there over and over again, just really planted it at one of my absolute three favorites in the world. I loved it after one, but there's no way that you're not going to want another taste at some of those holes a second time, right? I mean, just to go back and just keep banging putts off the wall on the pit, or trying to get over it in different ways. You're definitely not going to pick the right line on a whole bunch of the holes, and the wind's going to change. And that's half the time you go around, even, like St. Andrews, you're not going to know where you're going. At least you still won't probably after 10 plays. But I do think it's, if you can, I do think that the ideal way, if you really want to study stuff, is to walk and then play. But sometimes playing just at least twice, not necessarily twice in the same day, but within a week or so, you'd see a lot of different things. You'd end up in a lot of different places. You'd see things from different angles. I think it makes a big difference.
Yeah, so everybody just needs to quit their jobs and go over there and play for a year, right? At least.
I wish. You just gotta find a way to get your job to take you closer. That's the trick.
Yeah, it's the best spot in the world, in terms of concentration, without a doubt.
It's pretty good. Pretty good.
So we'll look for this. It'll be up every Tuesday. Eclectic 18 articles. And we'll be hole one's up. The Prestwick write up's up, and next week we'll have hole two, which is probably going to surprise some people, right?
Yeah, I hope so.
Definitely.
All right, maybe we'll do a pod when we get done with this and talk more in depth about some of the decisions.